there's a saying from that people have attributed to Francis of Assisi. This was one of these preachers from yesteryear. Now, he was a fire and brimstone preacher. The guy was a hardcore preacher, and he was a very convicting man. And the saying that people have attributed to him incorrectly, you can't find it in any of his writings, is preach the word. If you have to, use words. This is the saying. It's incorrect. That's not what Paul tells Timothy. Paul tells Timothy, preach the word. Stick to it. Speak it. All right, now listen to this. Just an example. Have you ever heard the news report at right before the 11 o'clock news? They'll say, tonight, we'll have the news. And if we have to, we'll use words. You've never heard that, right?
No.
Because news, by its nature, this comes straight from this guy, D.A. Carson. He makes a great point. News, by its nature, is spoken. It's words. You say it. And when you preach the word, preaching is saying. It's proclaiming. It's speaking it. You can't act out the words. You have to say them. That is to say, the point of that, preach the word, and if you have to use words, is, or preach the gospel if you have to use words. The point of saying that is, don't let your life be only preaching and that you don't authenticate that message with acting. That you have to act right. And that's a good point. But the wrong point from that is that it's saying that the message doesn't have to be said. It has to be said. It has to be spoken. And we need to stick close to it. That, I think, can now bring us into the book of John and how we study. Because I'm going to put up this line here. All right? So we have preach the gospel or the word. If you have to, use words. Right? This is going to bring us right in here. When we see this sentence, preach the gospel if you have to use words, it's a simple sentence, right? But this sentence actually has a lot of information. It has a lot of information. I think it has at least three things that it's saying. So let's get some interaction then. So let's tell me something that it says in this sentence.
You have the word in you. It's possessed.
It says you have the word. So so we'll say this exists, right?
Yes.
This exists. That there is a word. There is something to be said. So the sentence says that there is something called the gospel. There is the word, right? What else does this sentence say? Yes. That you can preach it. So this sentence actually says that you can do something with this message. This says that you can do some sort of proclaiming, whatever that action is. But what else does this sentence say?
Could it say also that the prefix, it says, if you must use the word, the prefix would be your stand in life. People see something different in you before you preach.
Yes. All right. So here is this other part of this sentence, that there is something else. Something else. It's something that's seen, right? So this sentence contains all this information. It tells you that there's something that exists called the gospel. There's something that you can do with it, proclaim it. And it's telling you that there's something else that's different from preaching that is seen. But it's also telling you, there's one aspect here, if you have to use words, it's saying whatever this preaching is, you don't need to use words. That's what it's saying, right? Now, I'm just using that examination not to tell us what the book of John says, but to tell us, give us a little hint of how we can go in and study the book of John. That means that, like, remember before I said that the Bible is like a fruit that you could keep squeezing to get the juice out of. Out of this one sentence, we just pulled out at least four statements, at least four ideas from here, that there is a gospel, that you can't preach it, that there's something else that can be seen, and this something else is different from saying it with words. Four things from one sentence.
Does that also suggest that the priority would be, when you say you have to, there's another priority and it has to be seen first, is that a priority?
That's what it's saying. Yeah. This is why my main problem with this is that it's saying the priority is the seeing, when the scriptures tell us the priority is the preaching. Remember in the book of Nehemiah. So Nehemiah, the people gather together and they've rebuilt the walls and they're rebuilding the place and they find the book of the law. You know what Ezra does in Nehemiah chapter 8? He sets up a podium. He opens up the book of the law and he starts teaching from it. And he says that he starts translating it to the people. And the people are broken. That's where they're broken. Well, now, they had some weeks and months of doing some hard work. But here, finally, is what broke them. The word being preached. So we just got five statements out of this one sentence. How much more, then, when we go into the book of John, can we squeeze sentences like this? So when we study the book of John, I've had you guys reading it already several times, right? During this past month. And there's things that came in on the book of John that you've noticed just passively reading. Just passively reading. That means that you just sat in the chair and you read. I'm sure like Josias, you probably woke up in the morning, right? You opened up John and you read, right? And me, I would open up, I'll sit on the sofa and I read. I'm not asking any raised hands. How many of us read with pens and papers in hand? Not raising hands. Just asking yourself, how many of you read asking the text hard questions? Asking it hard questions. For example, here's a hard question that we can ask. So we have, does anybody know when the book of Mark was written?
When it was written?
Yes, when?
AD 55 to 65.
All right. Now they tell us that Mark is one of the earliest books that was written. That's what they tell us.
Who's they?
Yeah, the scholars and the people who study languages tell us this, that it was written then. But for the sake of just purposes and getting through what we're trying to do, does anybody know what happened in history on 70 AD?
Rome was sacked.
Rome sacked
Jerusalem.
Rome sacked Jerusalem. And what happened in Jerusalem when they sacked it? Well, you recall? The Romans did something very interesting. Now, mind you, they didn't have in the temple, they no longer had the Ark of the Covenant. This was Herod's temple, and he was trying to make it better than Solomon's temple. It had gold everywhere and gold inlaid. And the Romans went in, and they took it down brick by brick, burnt the thing down so that the heat could get the gold to come out of the cracks. That's how far they took it down. So this is actually fulfilling a prophecy that Jesus says in the book of Matthew, where he says, this temple, not a stone's going to be left standing. This is going to get brought to the ground. And Jesus said this before it happened. Now, the thing is, Mark wrote that down before it happened too. But how do they know this? They'll go into the Bible and they'll ask hard questions. And as they read Mark, even though Jesus says things about the temple, they don't find, because this would be key. This would be key information. If the temple gets destroyed, the writers would have said it. They would have said, and this happened. But no one writes it. They don't put it down. They say nothing about it. So they take, these scholars, they take this question, this hint, and they see, since Mark didn't put it down, and this happened, this had to be written before it happened. So then They read, let's say, the book of Matthew. And they see that Matthew has similarities with Mark. So they'll tell you that Matthew was written around the same time. Maybe a little bit after Mark. But still, not at 70 AD. Because Matthew doesn't also, he doesn't say, and this happened. He doesn't say it. He's quiet about it. This is just precursor stuff, so don't worry about this so much. So Matthew doesn't say this happened. Who was Mark, by the way? Do we know who Mark was?
Your doctor.
No, he's not the doctor. That's
Peter's
Luke.
Brother Luke.
He was no. Peter's
his brother.
Hey, not really.
He was his student.
He was a student. Yes, that's right. He was Peter's student. So Mark, that people think that Mark based a lot of his writings based on Peter's confessions and telling him this is what happened. That's what people think. Sounds pretty good. Because we see things happening in the book of Mark that's constantly focused on Jesus serving, constantly, that Jesus going off and doing this, doing this, doing that. And it could be that Peter sat there and he said, he was always doing stuff. Possible. Whatever. Matthew, he writes, again, a gospel. He's not focusing on events exactly like Mark. He uses the same events, and he's writing around the same time. Who was Luke? Well, but who was Matthew, anyway, before I go any farther? Who was Matthew? He was a
tax collector.
That's right, tax. And he was one of the disciples, right? So here we have Mark, who was not one of the 12, and we have Matthew, who was one of the 12, right? Mm-hmm. And then we have Luke. What's interesting about Luke, right? Mm-hmm. Luke was a doctor. He was a traveling companion of Paul. And what's fantastic about finding out about Luke, Paul's writings are some of the earliest writings we actually have of the Bible. Some of the earliest notes that we have from the scriptures is from Paul's writings. Because Paul was writing, I mean, Jesus died in 33, right? 33 AD, right? And just a few years after that, Paul was in active ministry. So Paul's in active ministry somewhere from 40 to 67 or so. Whatever. The case is that Paul is working and Luke is a traveling companion with him. What's interesting about this is that Paul sometimes, I'll have to find the passage, maybe Ron knows it or Dan, quotes scripture, and when he quotes scripture, he's quoting some of the Gospel of Luke. Isn't that interesting? So he quotes something that Jesus said, and the structure of what he says comes right out of the book of Luke. So then you look at it and you say, Luke was writing scripture around the same time. Now, Luke wasn't one of the 12. He was a traveling companion of Paul. But Luke starts off his gospel, and he says, this is what Luke says. He says that, I've done my research. You can look it up in Luke 1. I've done my research, O Theophilus. I've asked many people. Other people have tried to go about having an account of all these things that happened. I went about it my way, and I've gathered all the notes. So that tells us that Luke, not only was he a doctor, he was a historian. The guy was a researcher, and he went about, and he says that there was other people who had tried to take and compile something about the life of Christ. So that means that Luke might have already known about Mark and Matthew. Might have. Whatever the case may be, Luke was also writing. So that all being said, when did John write his letter? Now, the text never says. But what's interesting, when you read the book of John, it's very different from these books. In the book of John, you saw a miracle that was in all the other gospel accounts. Matthew has it, Mark has it, Luke has it. The feeding of the 5,000. John has it as well. He includes it. And yet, John has a whole mess of new stuff that he includes too. Matthew, Mark, and Luke have the death and the resurrection of Christ. So does John. But then, the only one who has the resurrection of Lazarus is John. the only one who has the message of Jesus speaking on the cross to John and to Mary, his mom, is John. The only one who has a conversation with Jesus talking to Mary about telling the disciples that he's going to his father is John. The only one who has a discussion with Jesus and Nicodemus is John. Isn't that strange? So when we look at this, I'm going to tell you now what the scholars say. The scholars will tell you that John was written actually very late, 85 or something like that, 88. That's what they'll tell you. And why do they tell you that? Let's open up the book of John. Finally, right? He can shut up and say what he was talking about. John, look at verse 20. John chapter 20. Peter, John 21, verse 20. John 21, verse 20. Thank you. Now, Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved. Let's stop there. This is what's interesting. This disciple whom Jesus loved. This is a phrase that's constantly repeated throughout the book of John. The book of John never says John wrote the book. Never says it. Neither does Matthew. Matthew's gospel doesn't say Matthew wrote it. Mark's doesn't say Mark wrote it. Luke says that I have taken upon doing this account, O Theophilus. John doesn't say who wrote this book. But when you compare the list of disciples who are mentioned, when he gets to the 12th disciple and he's mentioning all the names of disciples, he'll say about the 12th one, who we know from the other gospels is John, he says, the disciple whom Jesus loved. That's what he does. So people have, for years, have seen this and they said, well, this is John. But apparently, also in church history, one of John's students also said, and this was very late, also said that he was writing the gospel. So this is like from the first century. Anyway, going back to verse 20, Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who had also leaned back on Christ's bosom at the supper and said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? So Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, and what about this man? Jesus said to him, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Therefore, this saying went out among the brethren that that disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but only, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? This is what's important here. John wouldn't have written that way here early on. He wouldn't have written that Jesus was saying he was going to remain if Peter was still around and all the other people were still around. He wouldn't have said that. Here's a quote from John writing in his gospel, and he's saying, it looks like I'm alive for a long time, but Jesus didn't say that I would live forever. And he puts that down. So this is one of those clues that people see this and they say, survivors, one of the people who was not around here in 70 AD, and he was around much later. Very possible. And one of the other signs that we see that he was around much later is that it looks like, just from reading the text, that he knows that these other books are around. Because he doesn't repeat their stories. He doesn't repeat their stories. So, for example, let's say the news stories that we have on television. Everybody repeats the same news story, right? Everybody's repeating it. And it's blasted all over the media. You go forward a few years, and you have somebody write a book about the big news stories that happened. So, for example, if you read a book about the first Iraq war, the Persian Gulf War, you'll find a book here and a book there referring to the first Persian Gulf War, right? That's fine. Now it's not happening during the moment. It's referring to those events. But if years pass and somebody else starts writing a history book, they won't only refer to the events. they'll refer to the people who wrote about those events. And they'll refer back to the books. And they'll do that. Now, John does something like that insofar as that he doesn't go into the details of the other disciples covered, these guys covered. So, for example, in John chapter 13, when Jesus started, let's turn to John chapter 13 real quick. John chapter 13. Now, this is verse 1, John 13, verse 1. Before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, that he would depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, got up from supper, laid aside his garments, taking a towel, he girded himself. Then he yada, yada, yada. And then for the next few chapters, we get conversation. Conversation. How long is the upper room discourse in the book of Matthew, Mark, and Luke? How long is the discussions that we see happening in the upper room?
No more than half a chapter.
Short.
Very short. Yeah. We see the dipping. We see the dipping of the bread.
That's it.
Nothing else. John's the only one who spends chapter 13, 14, 15, 16, and then 17 giving us upper room discourse. The only one. Isn't that interesting? So John, he sat down and he looks at these other books. I'm just pretending. I'm putting ourselves into John's shoes. This is one of these things for studying the Bible. You put yourself into the shoes of the author and you say, why did this guy write this book? He looks back at these guys and he doesn't repeat the same story. He gives us more information. Why would he do that? Did anyone see in the book of John why John wrote his book? Did anyone see it on their travels? Yeah. Yeah, shout it out.
Right at the end there somewhere.
2031.
All right. So, Bill, if you don't mind reading verse 31.
For these things were written, that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name.
So here, John says something. Now, remember, we were examining a statement before. We were breaking down that sentence. Preach the gospel, if you have to use words. Let's examine this section here, this verse, to find out, is this the reason John wrote this book? Look at verse 31. But these have been written. Let's stop there. But these have been written. What is he talking about? Is he talking about the whole book? Is he talking about part of the book? We have to look at the verse before. We're catching it. If you look at your verse there, it probably does not have an uppercase B. Even if it does, the word but, or the word for, or the word therefore, are all words that you have to stop and ask the question. If I see the word therefore or for, what is it there for? It's the same thing with but. I see a but, where's the head of the sentence? So you have to go back to the beginning of the sentence and look at verse 30. Therefore, we have another therefore. Many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of disciples, which are not written in this book. So here John says outright, that there's a whole bunch of other miracles, and they're not in this book. But, he says in verse 31, these what? These signs have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. So John tells you that there's a whole bunch of other miracles that Jesus did, a whole mess of them. But these have been written so that you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. That should make you be asking a question in your head. What signs are supposed to do that? I thought any sign was supposed to do that. I mean, if Jesus did a miracle, I mean, there he is in the book of Matthew, in the book of Mark. Here's a man with a withered hand, and he tells him to stretch out his hand, and he does. Well, that's a miracle right there, right? Shouldn't that be enough to prove that Jesus is the Son of God? But John doesn't think so. He never quotes that miracle. What's he doing? So this should be making us ask questions about the text. Why is John writing what he writes? Why does he include the signs that he does. Do you know how many miracles there are in the book of John? How many signs there are? And John is the only one. He makes a pointed effort. He doesn't call them miracles. He calls them signs. You know how many there are? Eight. Eight, if you don't include the resurrection of Christ. Eight signs. So here you are. Put yourself in John's shoes. You want to prove that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. How many signs would you include in your story to prove that he's God? You'll say, as many as possible, right? Well, I'll put in more. Why did John stop at eight? Why didn't he include nine? Why didn't he include 20? If you really want to show that Jesus is the Son of God, why didn't he keep going? Well, let's go further down. Look at John 21 again. John 21, not John chapter 20. Look at John 21, verse 24. So this is John telling you he's the one who's writing these things. He says, this is the disciple who is testifying to these things and wrote these things. And we know that his testimony is true. There are also many other things which Jesus did, which if they were written in detail, I suppose that even the world itself would not contain the books that would be written. So John then tells you, look, I'm telling you stuff that's the truth. I wrote these things and I'm telling you about these things. And then he says, there could be more and there could be so much that it's not even going to fill a book. So if that's the case, pretend, let's put ourselves again. This is part of our study method. Put yourself in John's shoes. You're sitting down to write a book. These books already exist. Matthew, Mark, and Luke. You're sitting down and you have all these signs and work that Jesus did. Why did John choose the signs that Jesus did in this book? Why did he do that?
He was personally affected by those signs.
Could be. But he outright says, these were written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. So you're right. He could have been personally affected. If we're putting ourselves into his shoes, these things were things that stuck with him. And yet, intellectually, in his mind, he made a connection that if you have these signs, they tell you that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Now, we didn't finish examining that sentence, verse 31. So let's go back to that. So one, we see that there's specific content that John picked. This is John 20, verse 31. Specific content that John picked. Specific verses that he picked. And these were written so that you believe that Jesus is the Christ. What is he saying there? Jesus is the Christ. Now, we, unfortunately, we treat Jesus as the Christ as a last name. So, like, I would be Ray Reynoso, and Marty would be Marty Roach, and Jesus would be Jesus Christ. But what is the Christ?
The anointed one.
Messiah, the anointed one. And what does that mean?
Chosen.
Chosen. What does that mean? Let's squeeze this fruit. Let's get some stuff out of this. What does it mean to be chosen, anointed? What is it? Huh?
Appointed.
Appointed. Appointed one. So we have this word that Jesus is the Christ. But can anybody be appointed? Why did John say Jesus is the Christ? If anointed and chosen and appointed means those things, then couldn't John have said Jesus is appointed, or Jesus is Christ. Jesus is
the Son of God.
The one who's been picked. Why did he have to say the appointed one?
Because he's God. Yes.
There were other appointed ones in the Old Testament. Other messiahs.
Yes, exactly. There was other messiahs. There was other messiahs in the Old Testament. So we find out that, for example, in the book of Samuel, Samuel goes over to Saul. And he, it says, anoints him with oil. So who was Messiah there at that point?
Saul.
He was Messiah. He was anointed. He was chosen. And then we find out he was really chosen by God to be the king. And then David winds up being anointed and appointed. Even the high priests were anointed and appointed. So that category of being anointed and appointed is something that's in the Old Testament. But this one, John is saying there's something different here. He's the Christ. Now we're going to go over to the God part. So it says, the Son of God. Now, why didn't John say at this point, Jesus is the Christ, the appointed one, God? Why didn't he say that? Why didn't he say, Son of God? Now, before we go into the mistakes that the Romans might have believed, Romans believed that one of the gods maybe goes with one of the women, human women, and then they have a son. And then you have Hercules. He's half God, half man. He's a son of the gods. Is that what John is saying? Or is he saying something else? Well, when we've been going through the book of Psalms, we see this idea of Son of God. There's something about Son of God that's completely different than what the Romans think about God, sons of the gods. There's something different here. And it's highlighted by the term the Christ. So this sentence is giving us two things about Jesus. He's the Christ. He's the Son of God. And remember, tie it back to what it's talking about. The signs in this book are supposed to prove that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So that being the case, let's stop there for a second. As part of our studying, do you think we should be spending time looking at the signs to see what they say that prove that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God?